Everyone's asleep.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to a very special Kiwi Collaborator episode on the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest joining me for the first segment is Evelyn Gilbert from Aotearoa, a wider perspective.wordpress.com. Evelyn, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Now, the topic for today is the current Prime Minister of New Zealand, Freudian slip. Of New Zealand, John Key, and his banking past, and who he really is, and what have you, because we've elected him twice already. When I say the we, I mean the sheep, who are stupid enough to vote for somebody who they don't know or have any clue what the hell their back record is. So what we want to do is give the New Zealand public a full background check, okay? Like if you ever wanted to get an employee or something of that nature to do something for you, you better find out what the hell their background is. And today we're going to be looking at some of the background elements of who this man, John Key, in fact, actually is. Evelyn, would you like to take it away?
John Key is a man who started here in New Zealand as a foreign exchange trader, and he has basically made his whole career from round about 86 all the way to 2001 in the foreign exchange, but not just the foreign exchange, which is basically, you know, buying and selling different currencies and making a profit. But what he was also very good in, and what he did from almost day one, in fact, in the first 2 months of his employment at the Bankers Trust Bank here in New Zealand, he was very active in the then nascent derivatives trade. And he grew his career basically on the derivatives that were used in the foreign exchange, which really is just gambling. So that's what he's been doing his career before he came back, or you could say sent back, to do a stint as a politician in a high position. In fact, he made it a condition that if he came back to do politics here, he didn't want to start as a backbencher, work his way up. He wanted to be put up front straight away. Vincent.
Well, what kind of personality type are we talking about here?
That's a very interesting question, because they've done they wanted to investigate, and they wanted to do a science project and learn more about psychopaths in Switzerland. And so they had a check. What you always have is you have a check group. You know, you have a sort of you that you ask the same questions from, and that you hope will give you something to measure the results that you have with your known psychopaths. against. And it turned out that every foreign, because they used a foreign exchange group of foreign exchange traders, and every single one of them was more psychopathic than the psychopaths that were in jail. So that's the kind of personality disorder or type you're talking about.
We're talking about the new term. What was it called? The corporate psychopath.
Very much so. Yes, very much so.
Okay, so the characteristics of these people are they smile a lot, but when they smile, it's different to other people. Like if you or I smile, Evelyn, you'll notice our eyes crinkle at the corners. You know, our eyes smile too when we're in our mouth. Does look at any picture of John Key when he's smiling.
Yes, his eyes don't smile. What's more, psychopaths are incredibly reckless. They don't have a conscience or a very small one. They have no problem lying or being caught lying. And as we know, John Key has been caught lying a lot of times, and it didn't seem to really make much difference to him when he was caught lying. These are all characteristics.
He simply passes them off and calls the people conspiracy theorists, or makes some kind of denigration against character when he's attacked. And this has indeed been my experience with psychopaths as well. It's almost like they're a form of scumbaggery judo, where if truth comes at them, they're capable of actually catching it like a baseball mitt and hurling it back at you at 100 miles an hour. And boy, get out of the way, mate.
Yeah. So if you're asking what kind of personality type are we talking about? Well, especially since he actually really floated to the top. If we're talking scum, it floats to the top. We're talking about a psychopath. He was, he was the actual global head for Merrill Lynch for foreign exchange. He was also the European head for bonds and derivatives. And that is very interesting because when he started to work for Merrill Lynch, which is after the Bankers Trust Bank collapsed due to fraud, Procter & Gamble suing the bank for fraud in the derivatives trade, he said, right, I'm out of here. And he was hired by Merrill Lynch to set up their derivatives department. And Merrill Lynch is an American bank, and he basically set up the London branch of Merrill Lynch for the derivatives and bonds trade. And they did that in the late 90s because you could do much more what would be considered fraudulent trading in the United States. It was legal in London. So that's where he got his. Oh, you got the Penny Brightus.
Yeah. Well, hold on, okay, just a sec there, Evelyn. We're coming back right now. We also have Penny Bright joining us. But before we go to Penny from waterpressure.wordpress.com, Evelyn's got a little something to finish. Go right ahead, Evelyn.
Okay, so John Key was sent to London to set up the Merrill Lynch Bonds and Derivatives Department in Europe, and they did so in London because London is far more deregulated than the United States with regards to banking and foreign exchange trading and derivatives trading. So he, in a way, set up a department where they could be much more fraudulent and deregulated. And not only did he do that, he was then sent to Ireland to set up a branch there as well because they had a lot of tax cuts, they had a lot of incentives for banks to come over. And as a part of that, he helped Ireland become, for a moment, very, very rich, but now also very, very poor. So that is his career in a nutshell. Hi, Penny.
I'm just in the middle of a mouthful. How are you?
I am good. I hear you're going to be speaking about John Key tonight as well.
Yes, I am. Yep. I just did a bit of just quick bit of research today. And speaking of the Irish, yes, it's an article that Fran O'Sullivan did with John Key back in July the 20th, 2005, saying that Key chases Luck of the Irish. And I've done a bit of research, yeah, what he said at the time and how wonderful it's going to be. And then, of course, Ireland went clunk. And so what I want to know is how much is John Key personally responsible for the stuff-up of the Irish economy?
And did you find anything that could lead you to a conclusion?
Absolutely. I don't know if I've got time to do it now. I'll have a go. So it's just that, I mean, we've still got these reporters, Fran O'Sullivan. I really think she needs to review. She said back on the 20th of July 2005, in light of Ireland going clunk. So, all right, so what she said in this article was banking boards and governance company taxation, economy, fiscal policy, foreign policy, interest rates, New Zealand, National MP, because he wasn't the Prime Minister in 2005, National MP John Key gets a gleam in his eye when he starts talking about New Zealand becoming the Jersey of the South Pacific. Quote, why not have an offshore banking industry based here? He asks. Quote, in the right conditions, you could attract 200 banks to register here, each with a CEO and staff. You could attract insurance companies, bring back lots of Kiwi accountants and lawyers, single out clusters such as high-class yachts or other special sectors, as the Irish did, unquote. Key is clearly on a roll as he lists the options New Zealand could explore if it decided to abandon outdated ideology and take a more pragmatic approach to growing the economy. The former investment banker knows what he is talking about. As head of global foreign exchange for investment giant Merrill Lynch, he shifted a considerable amount of his business to Ireland in the mid-1990s to take advantage of a 10% tax rate for foreign investors. The investment was a runaway success. So that's where I've left the article. So has our Prime Minister John Key helped thousands of his clients avoid or minimise tax by shifting business to Ireland? So how did that work out for Ireland?
So he's literally a professional tax dodging consultant.
Well, effectively.
In charge of a country.
Scary.
Well, what has happened here in over the last couple of years is that they send up what is called a clearinghouse. And a clearinghouse is basically nothing but a fund that helps
slush fund?
People. It's a slush fund, yes. It really literally is a slush fund. And it helps people deal in derivatives trade. So he's brought the derivatives trade to the exchange here, the stock exchange here. And one of the derivatives that they came up with was the dairy derivatives. Nowhere done in the entire world, only in New Zealand. So he has brought a lot of trust work, a lot of derivatives trade to New Zealand, same way as he did with Ireland. I don't know to what extent. I don't know the amounts of money we're talking about, but with $112 billion in 2011 of derivatives on our books, I dare say he's done a fair bit.
How much were on the books around 2008? Do we have any of that information?
Well, these are good questions which we need to follow up. But what I'd really like to do, if I could have maybe 3 or 4 minutes, I can just go through and then give the facts about what happened to Ireland. Because is that okay?
By all means.
Okay. All right. So this is the link that I got. And it says, the boom becomes a bubble. However, from 2002 onwards, the nature of the boom began to change. Labour productivity was no longer increasing. Inflation was high, and growth in GDP increasingly became related to the housing market. Across the economy, wage increases threatened competitiveness. By 2006, although the public finances still appeared strong, this was deceptive because much of the revenue the state took in was related to the property market. The property
is this in New Zealand?
No,
or
this is Ireland. No, this is Ireland. I'm trying to explain about, you know, going from the
you could be talking about New Zealand, of course.
Exactly,
it's the same thing is happening
here. Okay. The property related revenues included not only stamp duty and capital gains tax, but just as importantly, a large amount of VAT paid by developers, as well as income tax paid by workers in the very large construction sector. The tax base was effectively very narrow and dependent to a large extent on the housing boom. And then there's a graph, but despite this risk, Ireland continued to increase its public expenditure, funded expensive capital projects, but also allowing some categories of current spending to rise very rapidly. The speculative bubble in property was supported by a surge in bank lending, and the balance sheets of Irish banks grew disproportionately large relative to the size of the economy. Banks had traditionally relied on their deposit base to fund their lending activity. However, greater financial integration, spurred in part by the birth of the euro, allowed them to turn more and more to short-term borrowing from abroad and so-called wholesale money markets. This period also saw a global increase in risk appetite by financial markets, and the Irish banks were caught up in this. The crisis erupts in Ireland. By 2007, the housing market had reached its peak. That year, tax revenues began to decline markedly. New home completions fell for the first time since 1988. And in 2008, Ireland experienced its significant increase in unemployment in 15 years. Irish banks began to report arrears on their loan books, and with confidence evaporating, were faced with the prospect of deposit outflows. At the same time, short-term interbank lending, on which Irish banks had become heavily reliant for their funding, became difficult to access due to the international financial crisis. Responding to these pressures, the government decided to issue a blanket guarantee of the bank's liabilities and to recapitalise them using public funds. The large cost of these measures further exacerbated the structural budget deficit, which the housing market collapse had revealed. The bank debt was added to an already significant budget deficit, causing international investors to question the sustainability of Irish sovereign debt. In November 2010, yields on Irish government debt reached an unsustainable 9%, which meant that the government was effectively locked out of international bond markets. Unable to borrow to fund the deficit, Ireland would have faced a devastating and abrupt adjustment to public services, as spending would have had to be brought in line with revenue immediately. So what happened? The EU IMF Economic Adjustment Programme for Ireland. To avoid this prospect, on November 29, 2010, the government negotiated a financial assistance package with the EU and the IMF, totalling £85 billion, including a contribution of $17.5 billion from Ireland's owned resources. The financing provided by the program partners is helping to cushion the very large shock which Ireland's economy and public finances have suffered as a result of the bursting of the bubble. It is helping to keep vital public services running. In July 2011, EU leaders agreed to reduce the interest rate. and to extend the maturity on EU loans provided to Ireland under the programme. This decision brought about a significant saving to Irish taxpayers and has helped to improve the country's debt sustainability. Three main elements. The programme contains three main elements. First, a financial sector strategy is helping Ireland to have a smaller, better capitalised banking sector. Second, fiscal consolidation will put the country's public finances on a sustainable path over the medium term. I'm nearly there. Third, an ambitious structural reform agenda will restore competitiveness and strengthen the economy's growth potential. Although broad policy targets in these three areas are agreed between the programme partners, the Irish authorities, the EU, the IMF and the ECB, European Central Bank? Implementation is a matter for the Irish government, which has a democratic mandate from the Irish people. So that's the bursting of the Irish bubble. So my comments, and I've posted this everywhere today, actually, I just say, bugger, not such a brighter future for Ireland. For whom exactly was this investment a runaway success? Doesn't look like it's been such a raging success for the poor old Irish 99%.
Well, hold on a second. Didn't John Key run away after he caused that situation a successful man?
Well,
so isn't he, in the very sense of the word, the runaway success?
Arguably. I mean, if you watch the Wolf from Wall Street, what it shows, it's all bubble and fluff. The only ones making any dough are the ones who are selling these dodgy products. Anyway, just to finish this off, just half a minute. So the question is, so in whose interest is New Zealand Prime Minister John Key working? Follow the dollar. So I link straight to the New Zealand MP's Register of Pecuniary and Financial Interests, the Right Honourable John Key, National, Helensville, two other companies and business entities, Little Nell Property Investment, Aspen, Colorado, Bank of America Banking. So I've sent that far and wide today. Yeah, so that's the question, folks. How much is our, Mr. Marvellous, the poodle from Wall Street, personally responsible for this, the stuff-up of the Irish economy?
What is another question that needs answering is how much will he do the same here? Well, that will tell you. That will tell you how responsible he is if he does the same thing here. What I know from the Cullen Fund, for example, last year it got a prize for being the most innovative pension or whatever fund, national fund, and that tells me that they're dabbling in instruments. They know nothing about financial instruments, and that's 19 billion. We know that our national debt went from 8 billion to 60 billion over the last 7 years, and we know that as of 2011, we have 112 billion in derivatives on the books.
This is like the financial equivalent of that scene in the movie The Mummy where they start to open the Book of the Dead and they go, no, you don't know what you're playing with.
Well, the question is, that's the thing, is to ask these questions. But, I mean, as you know, Ev, back in 2008, here's me trying to take a private prosecution against John Key to show that he's an insider trader over Transrail, which he was. And, I mean, the fact is that he's just brought his Wall Street ways with him. And when you see that film, The Wolf of Wall Street, I mean, I just couldn't believe it. It was no rules, no laws, no regulations, no ethics, no morals. It was just, it's absolute just market madness, free market capitalism at its literally most debauched. And these people are not used to anybody holding them account. And so this is a big deal. These questions, these hard questions need to be asked. Well, I've put it out there today. I've sent it directly to John Key, to National Party cabinet ministers, to MPs across the different parties, to all various mainstream media, key reporters, including Fran O'Sullivan. And I think Fran needs to do the right thing here. She needs to now follow up from her 2005 story. What happened, John Key? What went wrong? And how much are you personally responsible?
Did you know that in 2012, John Key went to London? He went to Europe. He signed this on in a new treaty with NATO, a new, not just a little bit elaboration on the old one, a brand spanking new treaty that we know nothing about. But he also went to visit London and the then governor of the Bank of England.
This guy, let me just break this down for you, ladies and gentlemen. We're talking about a henchman, an economic hitman of the highest level, as in we're talking about the right hand of the financial elite here. Oh, we need to do this. Let's send this guy in, you know. Hey, I mean, have you ever seen Pulp Fiction, where they accidentally shoot a guy in the face and they need somebody to come and clean it up and do all the business that everybody else is panicking and just really can't do? Because they're not a psychopath and they've got a conscience and they think about stuff before they do it.
Well, you do have to ask, why did John Key go from Wall Street to Molesworth Street in Wellington? Mm. And when you look at what he's done since he's been in power, particularly since he's been in power, I mean, the closeness of the ties with the United States, it's really scary. And where does he get his mandate? All this, it's not just the closer ties with the banksters, but the whole military-industrial machine tying us closer to NATO, etc. Well, when did the people of New Zealand say, yeah, that's what we want?
Well, as I said, Penny, the last time John Key had a mandate date was with John Banks in a cafe. All right, so we'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. Don't you go anywhere. Hold on to your popcorn and your low-tax cigarettes. We'll be right back.
Pale, 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 politician, can you make a right decision for all of us? For all of us. Pale, 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 politician, can you make a right decision for all of us? Yeah. Can you make a right decision for all of us? Yeah, for all of us. You can talk the talk, but will you walk the walk? And will you bring us comfort? And will you bring us comfort?
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guests joining me are, I'd probably say two of the women that I respect most in this country, which is actually quite high esteem to put it. We've got Evelyn Gilbert from Aotearoa, a wider perspective.wordpress.com, and Penny Bright at pennybright4mia.com. Is it .com or .co.nz or is it .org?
.org.
It's the, okay. I forget these things sometimes. If you Google Penny Bright for Mia, with the number 4, it should come up in a search result of some description. Not to mention, if you're listening to this on the Vinnie Eastwood Show archives, by the way, search names of people on the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. There's a little search bar in that little pub right up there, in that little space where nobody seems to look when they ask me, where are all the archives, Vinnie? There's a little search thing there. You can put any topic, any name you want. I've interviewed shockingly large amounts of people. It's obscene. It's disgusting. It's sickening how many people I've interviewed. It'll blow your freaking mind daily if you want to keep listening to it. Anyway, back to the show. And enough with the shameless self-promotion. And we also have Penny Bright and Evelyn Gilbert with us today, and we're discussing the late Prime Minister John... Oh, sorry. The current Prime Minister... If you call him late prime minister, does that mean he's dead?
Because
that was where I was going with that. And I'm sorry. I'm not saying I want him to kill him myself. It's just if some magical miracle fairy heart attack machine designed by the CIA or something will just happen to fall into his lap during a speech or some description, I would be in mourning. I would be in mourning until the afternoon. That's what I'm saying.
I'm going to kick his butt in Helensville. I'm standing against John Key in Helensville. It's a really simple argument, which is why would you waste your electorate vote in Helensville on John Key when he's going to be number one on the National Party list? And even if not one single person in Helensville voted for him, he'd still get into Parliament. So it's sort of like the two-for-one thing. Of course, we're on sort of different galaxies, which is a more technical point.
Speaking of which, at this particular moment, Evelyn has to go very shortly. So I'd like to hear from her while we still can, because let's face it, we all have personal lives. Things need to be attended to. So, Evelyn, if you've got any choice phrases for the 9-year-olds out there, go for your life.
I agree with Penny that a waste for John, a vote for John Key would be a waste. And I hope that your show and the things that we can bring out over the next 2 months will help people make a better choice. And I salute Penny, and I hope she succeeds in Helensville. I want to extend to her my offer that I would like to help Graham McGreen in his fight against John Key, because I think you can really seriously make a case for him as insider trader and for being one of the people who are very high up in the global financial crisis. And it would be nice to be able to do some research with someone who is taking his grievances so well to court and who was so successful in fighting John Banks together with you, Penny.
Well, just so that you know, on Bastille Day, the 14th of July, what is happening is Graham McCreedy will be filing in the Auckland District Court a great wad of documents in which John Key is named as basically an accessory after the fact regarding John Banks's electoral fraud, because that whole thing was disgraceful. When you look at the numbers in Parliament, 61-60. So the vote of dodgy John Banks was pivotal in order to get through the public finance mixed ownership model bill, with the privatisation of our electricity assets, the GCS bill, etc. And I mean, John Key refused point blank to read the police report. All this willful blindness. So the media have picked it up. He's been very successful getting media coverage, Graham, and full credit. But one of the things that he intends to append to his documents is a DVD of The Wolf of Wall Street, on the basis that this is effectively a form of evidence of how they were on Wall Street, which is where John Key came from. You know, no laws, no regulations.
John Key himself confessed to going to strip clubs. And he made it out like it was, that's what you did for your customers, but I had a wife and kids at home. But he was very much aware. And it is really, when you are that high up and when you've got that kind of business going, trading in billions and billions, and with this, we only know of 50 million that he allegedly made, but that puts him in a very elite group of only 202,000 people in the world. So that is, for all intents and purposes, an extremely successful stroke of good luck and selling selling derivatives and getting bonuses.
Oh, it's just the luck of the Irish, it is.
No, that's okay.
Well, we know with Transrail that he did effectively insider trading when he was an MP and he had undisclosed shares in Transrail. He tried to flush out commercially sensitive information, and which was declined by Treasury. And yet he still tried to flush out commercially sensitive information by making a complaint to the Ombudsman. And so talk about being quite persistent when it comes to feathering his own nest and filling his own pockets. Disgraceful. Well, I mean, you know, I got absolutely stuff all publicity about that back in 2008. But
I think that was me that gave you the publicity, Penny, and that was it. I'd only just started my YouTube channel.
I've been regurgitating that now so that people know. But the thing that occurs to me, I mean, when this same ex Wall Street banker is in charge of the GCSB, he's running the country. So your potential, if you're that way inclined, for insider trading at the highest levels is extraordinary in my view. And that's why, and I've challenged John Key to his face when I made a submission on the GCSB bill, and that also is on YouTube and people can see it for themselves. But I said, oh, this is an offer you probably haven't had so far today, Prime Minister. You show me yours and I'll show you mine. And everyone thinks, what? And I said, bank accounts. You open up your bank accounts. I want to see your trust accounts, your tax havens, your Swiss bank accounts. You, nothing to hide, nothing to fear. You show me yours and I'll show you mine. And I still hold by that because, you know, where would you be putting any dodgy dealings? Where would you be putting it?
See, that's the first thing you've got to ask him is, show me yours, I'll show you mine. And the second question is, where are you going to be putting it? I think that's appropriate. Evelyn's unfortunately had to leave us now. I've just taken this interview down a notch, Evan. I'm sorry. Now, what we're going to talk about now, Penny, I really want your take on this. Now, if John Key's a sociopathic, scumbaggery, economic hitman, and he's here to destroy the country, precisely in what way is he planning to destroy it?
Well, again, you know me. I'm very big on the facts and evidence. I want to know more about the amount that New Zealand is exposed to derivatives. I think 112 billion. When did New Zealand start getting involved in derivatives? How much has John Key helped to push that along? How's it been done? Who's involved? How did they do it? What does it mean for we 99%ers? What does it mean? And I don't have those enough facts at my fingertips right now, but that's okay because what I do know will help me ask some more very hard questions.
I have a real difficulty thinking about this quite clearly because it's a financial market. Now, everybody, when they think about financial markets, they think complicated. They think huge amounts of maths and things of that nature. Oh, I can't understand it. I can't understand. And what Evelyn told me the other day is that there was actually a quote from the, what was it, the Auditor General or something like that about KNP or some company. Maybe.
Yep.
That their records and financial trading and everything was so complex that they actually had to hire somebody from that company in order to check their own records for them, and they said they were fine.
Well, that's an actual really scary thing in itself. I mean, I've already told you, in my considered opinion, our Auditor General, Lynn Provost, is corrupt because she's a shareholder in Sky City and she didn't disclose that when I asked her to do an inquiry into a matter relating to Sky City. And that is just unbelievable, but it's a fact and Parliament has done nothing about that. So how corrupt is our Parliament? But what seems to happen is that so much auditing appears to be contracted out to the pinstripe mafia, the major accountancy firms, that's Deloitte, KPMG, PricewaterhouseCoopers and Ernst & Young. Well, hello, it's this same pinstripe mafia that is up to their eyeballs in tax, you know, tax avoidance, etc. So that was one of the big scandals. And on the one hand, they would have, their staff helping to work out packages by which their clients could avoid tax, and the next minute they're doing the auditing. Well, how the hell does that work? How the hell does that work? How is that not a major conflict of interest? So in my view, what we need, a genuine, proper, decent, public-spirited auditors, ones who work directly for, I mean, we need an independent commission against corruption, but we need decent people, you know, pay them well. I've got no problem with that. Pay them well, but people who can be trusted and who do have a moral compass. Because I'm telling you, these people, you know, the Wall Street wolves and poodles, they have no moral or ethical compass. That just doesn't exist on planet Key, in my view.
Which is called psychopath.
Well, you know, it's a real concern. But the other thing, and I'll come back to this because I'm really pushing this one as well. Well, we're looking at Ireland. We've got the details there about how John Key said it was a great success, and then, you know, about 2 or 3 years later, Ireland goes down the gurgler. But what people need to remember, and I need as many people as possible to pick up the ball here and ask this question themselves. What role did John Key play when he was the head of derivatives for Merrill Lynch and a foreign exchange advisor to the New York Federal Reserve back in November 1999 when the Glass-Steagall Act was repealed?
And let's qualify that as well, because he was handpicked for the role. Handpicked no less by some guy who's colloquially known, Reed, I think it is, as the most corrupt capitalist on earth. Like, second, what's his name? George Soros or something is number two on the list. This guy's number one, and he's apparently John Key's mentor who got him onto that board. There's a whole bunch of, like, how business is done with backroom deals and everything, Penny. You know, it's done over a whiskey, or it's done over personal choice or preference, and all these little wolves kind of like vying for the same carcass kind of thing. And there's a couple of big wolves on top that occasionally will chuck a scrap out to one of the little puppies. You know, that's kind of how this works. And we're talking about a man who's not just the right hand. He's been groomed for the position for a very, very long time. He's shown himself to be a diligent scumbag and incapable of doing the right thing to save his life.
It is really interesting, because my understanding is that John Key has since sort of put his hands up and is like, oh, no, like it's nothing to do with me. But what was pivotal to the global financial crisis was the fact that the derivatives market was completely without regulation. And the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act in November 1991, that left the derivatives market completely without regulation. So we know John Key's involved up to his eyeballs in derivatives. We know he's at a pivotal place, you know, at the highest levels of the banksterdom. At this pivotal position, pivotal time, what role did he play, John Key, in the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act? I know for a fact that his CEO at Merrill Lynch at the time, whose name temporarily escapes me, but he has subsequently sort of repented and said that, now I don't really think that we did do the right thing. And Clinton, who was the president who allowed this to happen, he's now said that, we made a bit of a mistake there with the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act. Well, meanwhile, the whole world has basically been hugely affected by this global financial crisis. So, you know, Mr. Popularity John Key, who must be the most spin doctor politician on the planet, God help me, there's this side to him, and we're talking truth and facts here, which show that he's just a walking disaster when it comes to the 99%, the ordinary people. He's a disaster.
You know, what occurs to me now is that he'd make a really good snitch. Imagine how much dirty business he could give, all the gossip on all of these big elite scumbaggery banksters and things of that nature, you know?
But why would he want to do that?
Well, if the alternative was penalty of death, well, you know, he'd cry us a derivative.
Well, anyway, well, like I say, there are things moving on the accountability front. So, like I say, on the 14th of July, Bastille Day, Graham McCreedy will be filing in the Auckland District Court court papers that are charging John Key as being an alleged accessory after the fact regarding John Bankster's electoral fraud case. And also Inspector Mark Benefield, who was basically the inspector in charge, he's also being charged. So, I mean, at last, someone sort of showing their teeth and actually doing a bit of serious biting. And it'll be interesting to see what happens in court. But to be fair to Graham, he has been getting significant success in getting matters into court where others have failed. And a lot of people now sort of see Graham as sort of, you know, a bit of a folk hero for having a go and having success. So, you know, there's been a few, you know, small group of us that have been helping. But I put the word out now on, I think it's Friday, the 14th of July, between 12 noon and 2 o'clock, we'll be having a presence, a little protest outside the Auckland District Court in Albert Street, and Graham will be filing his court paperwork. So hopefully there'll be a bit of a media scrum there. And John Key, just like John Banks, hopefully will learn that he also is not a protected species, and that although that may have been his background in terms of where he's come from, Wall Street, suddenly we now may see a changing scene.
I am not too sure about that, Penny, because, again, what happens with people when they're in powerful positions, it creates a vacuum around them and it puts pressure on everybody beneath them in their position of authority that usually gets them resentful and often willing to betray them and take their place, even if they're a sociopath like them. If they don't fear them because they're going to go down without a fight and whatnot, they'll do it. So here's another question. Once John Key goes down, eventually, what scumbag's going to take his place for the bankers and the 1%?
Well, the thing is that, I mean, the job of people like ourselves, who are whistleblowers for the 99%, the public don't ever get anything unless we make a fuss. That's it. We don't work in pinstripe suits lobbying at 30,000 feet. We've got to make a huge fuss about the issues. And in my view, this situation is becoming similar to New South Wales in the late 1980s, where there were these massive scandals about police corruption. And as a result of the huge public outcry, that is what helped New South Wales get their Independent Commission Against Corruption. Now, it's not all perfect in New South Wales, but I tell you what, they've got some better systems in place than we have in New Zealand, and that's what we need. We need a legislative framework that's going to help ensure a lot more accountability and transparency than what we've got at the moment. Yeah, that's what we need. We need a legislative framework.
Because at the moment, we're butterflied like a barbecue fried chicken.
Well, but what's good about it is that I think actually John Rom's portrait of a prime minister, the unauthorised biography of John Key, it actually has done us all a favour, because what it's done, it has actually focused on his banker background. And of course, with the Wolf of Wall Street movie, and I really do recommend people, if you haven't seen it, you've got to see it. Please.
It is the first movie Martin Scorsese has made since, like, whenever, that has actually held my attention the entire film and didn't lapse for 1 second. It is an amazing thrill ride of debauchery and scumbaggery.
And it's based on a true story, Jordan Belfort. And he, prior to the financial crisis in 2008, he was working in Wall Street where the brokers got 1% commission, and that's the area where that John Key would have been working in, that same area. But you need to go and see it for yourselves. I tell you what, it is an eye opener. It's stunning. It really is stunning, scary. It's like, oh my God,
yeah.
You couldn't make this up.
Well, you really can't. I mean, let's give them an analogy, okay? People go like, oh, why would somebody be such a scumbag and destroy the entire world's economy and enslave everybody ruthlessly with massive amounts of debt that they made up so they can just live in palaces and things of that nature and everybody else is just an enslaved parasite that they can kill at will? Why would somebody do that? I wouldn't do that. Well, imagine for a moment that you're an incredibly intelligent, ruthless criminal sociopath who hates the very existence of human life if you can't control it. Does it suddenly make a hell of a lot more sense to you, ladies and gentlemen? That's the reason why it's been confusing all this time. I wasn't thinking like a sociopath. Silly me.
Well, I mean, I think that this is going to be quite a pivotal election. I do. But you see, what I love about it is Team Key, which means the rest are lack keys. It's so much dependent on Shonky John. And as more and more people start to question and get an understanding of his background, and I mean, you know...
Well, can I make an interjection here, Penny? I'm so sorry to interrupt you, but we're coming to break any second now. Who do they turn to? And this is the problem, because I don't even believe in that kind of mentality of who do you turn to save you. I believe you should save yourself and actually take some personal responsibility for protecting your country from scumbaggery. All right? That's basically what I'm doing, ladies and gentlemen. I'm taking personal responsibility to protect my country from filth that will destroy it. Okay? What is your excuse, ladies and gentlemen? How many days a year do you sit back and not participate? How many days a year? How many years does it take in between election cycles? Do you think that waiting 1,000 days before you tick a box on a piece of paper and give it to some people to count for you will make the difference and stop people who have no conscience and no rules that they follow from destroying your nation? Do you think that's a worthy accomplishment? Do you think it's actually going to achieve anything in and of itself? You need to get real, ladies and gentlemen. All the methodologies of participation which the government allows for you and mainstream society has for you. Hey, look, you can text in and vote this way. You can do that and this and that and the other. Everything that they're telling you to do is only so that they can channel your energy, okay,
into something
that they can control. And
yeah,
but
you've got to be a little bit careful with that line of argument. Otherwise, it's sort of like, oh, you said, why bother?
The opposite. Okay. The opposite. I'm saying you don't need that system to make a difference. You can go out and make a hell of a lot more difference yourself. Do these things as well, but understand that they are only one out of 100 things that you might be thinking of doing in between election cycles.
Well, what I love is, I have found myself...
But Penny, we'll come back to this. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, okay. In just a few minutes.